I wanted to actually start my talk with this image here. This is a really weird map, essentially, that someone created of the history of science fiction. And I just love it because it's amorphous and weird and sort of represents what science fiction is to me. And in case you're curious, I probably land somewhere between space operas and cyberpunk. But the reason why I love this image is because this is what I think science fiction is really great at, mapping out guides to exploring the unknown and the undefined in our universe. And one of the most unknown and undefined phenomenons in our universe are black holes. Black holes are these incredibly dense areas of space and time that kind of are known for pulling in everything around them and gobbling everything up. In fact, there's something that used to be considered science fiction, but we now know there's around 100 million black holes in our galaxy alone. And they often get this very bad rep for gobbling up everything around them and being very destructive and chaotic. But we now know that black holes kind of do the opposite. Well, yes, they do pull in everything around them. They also vomit a lot of it back out into the universe. Essentially, they feed on all this stuff, and they feed off more than they can chew, and then they vomit it back out in this disgusting display of energy and particles out into the universe. And so, while, yes, they're maybe destructive and chaotic, we now know that they're actually also part of the evolution of galaxies and the universe, because the stuff that they spit out can potentially create entire galaxies and potentially even create life in the universe. So while we can't image black holes themselves, because even light itself can't escape from them, we can image its vomit. So what you're looking at here is M83, not the band, which is pretty cool, but the galaxy M83. And what you see in that circle is essentially black hole vomit. And so this is an example of that process, even a better image of it. Essentially this process of pulling in everything around it, mashing it up, and kind of spitting it back out into the universe in all these weird, unexpected ways. And why I'm fascinated with this phenomenon of black holes is because, to me, when I look at black holes, they're kind of like these supermassive hacker spaces to me. They're kind of like hacker spaces, this process of pulling in everything around you, mashing it up, and spitting it back out into the world in these weird and unexpected ways that might go on to create bigger and better ideas and bigger and better communities. And like black holes, hacker spaces have often gotten a bad rep for being these very chaotic forces, but we now know they can actually create a lot of good in the world. So science fiction, space exploration, and hacking, to me, all kind of remind me of this quote from John Peel, that at the heart of anything good, there should be a kernel of something undefinable. And if you can't define it, or claim to be able to define it, then in a sense, you've missed the point. So this is what I really love, is really exploring the unknown and the undefined in our universe. So I figured I'd talk through some of the unknown and undefined things, which to me are life, the universe, and everything. And everything is really fascinating because, in fact, 95% of everything is invisible. And when I say 95% of everything is invisible, I mean 95% of absolutely everything. This is a pie chart of the entire energy and mass in our universe. And as you can see, 74% is dark energy, 22% is dark matter, and the rest, less than 5%, is everything else in the universe. In fact, if you take out intergalactic gas, everything visible in the universe makes up less than 0.5%. So that's everything on this planet, every star, all of that makes up less than 0.5%. So we are very much the et cetera in the universe. But all the invisible stuff is really cool to me. Dark matter is this fascinating, invisible, weakly interacting particle stuff. Essentially, when we look out into galaxies and we see that they're all held together, there's actually not enough mass to account for enough gravity to hold everyone together. So we give this a sort of placeholder name of dark matter. And dark matter is kind of this globular stuff. While we can't actually image dark matter itself, we can image the effects of it. So this is actually an image of the effects of dark matter around galaxies. And so it's all this globular, weakly interacting stuff that kind of helps keep us all together. So it's not actually the power of love that helps keep us all together, but it's the power of dark matter that helps keep us all together and keep us all friendly. And so in a lot of ways, this is a very friendly universe. We have all this invisible, weakly interacting stuff that helps keep us all together and keep us all friendly. But there's also an opposite side to the universe, and that's dark energy. And dark energy kind of does the opposite. When we look out into the universe and we see that we're expanding, we actually see that we're expanding faster than we think we should be. So this gets the placeholder name of dark energy, and it's kind of helping pull us all apart and push us further and further away from each other. So 95% of everything is invisible. We have all these weakly interacting particles helping push us together and pull us apart and really help shape the universe. So in a lot of ways, not only is 95% of everything is invisible, but 95% of everything is weak interaction design. This isn't just for Facebook and QR codes, but it's actually the nature of the universe, and you can say it's proven by science now. But despite 95% of everything being invisible, we kind of have an optical overdose problem in our culture. This isn't a scene from a science fiction movie. This is actually a scene from the Large Hadron Collider, a particle accelerator. And this is kind of outlining a problem that we have, where if we need more information, we just simply give you more screens until you end up like this. And particle accelerators do deal with a lot of information. They're kind of these massive space-time smashers. Essentially, they're these massive, huge, expensive machines that take subatomic particles and collide them into other subatomic particles at very fast speeds. And for a brief moment, they turn into energy and then back into subatomic particles. The idea being, though, that when they turn back into subatomic particles, sometimes they turn back into really weird ones, ones that we would otherwise only see in a supernova or in the early stages of the Big Bang. So they are very much kind of exploring the nature of the universe and the nature of space-time. But they are also just really expensive machines for scientists to make pretty data visualizations with that they're very proud of. This is what one of those data visualizations looks like. I'm not a particle physicist, so I won't pretend to explain everything in this image to you, but essentially the four green lines and the four red towers in this image represent four high-energy electrons. And so data visualizations is often what these particle physicists are looking at. But a group of hackers at a science hack day wanted to know, what if instead of seeing what these particle collisions look like, what if we could hear what these collisions sound like? And so they created a hack called the particle wind chime. And what it does is it takes subatomic particle collision data and maps it to sounds. So again, if you could imagine what a subatomic particle collision might sound like, that's what they created. And it was a pretty fun hack, and it was cool to listen to all these different subatomic particle collisions and hear how much they may or may not sound like car collisions. But the cool thing about the particle wind chime is that it's now actually being looked into as sort of an augmented diagnostic tool in accelerator laboratories. So if you could imagine being at the Large Hadron Collider, which would be very cool in itself, but if you could imagine being there and being surrounded by all of these screens, but in addition to all of these screens, you could also get used to how the accelerator sounds and get used to if something sounds a bit off. That's essentially what the particle wind chime is being looked into as, which is pretty cool. There's also other ways of experiencing these otherwise invisible senses and invisible data. Some people actually experience this through something called synesthesia. And synesthesia is essentially something where the wires between your different senses get crossed. So some people with synesthesia might report associating certain colors with certain letters, or if they hear a loud sound, they might actually see a ripple across their vision. So a group of hackers at a different science hack day wanted to simulate what it would be like to experience synesthesia, what it would be like to actually experience it. And so they created this really creepy mask called synesthesia. It is creeptastic indeed. Synesthesia is essentially a mask that simulates what it's like to experience a specific type of synesthesia. And so what they did is they created this creepy mask. And they did so by using a bunch of vibrating speakers, and they attached it to someone's face. Because they only had 24 hours to prototype this, The only open pattern for a mask that they could find that they could sew together was one for a GIMP mask. So they just kind of went with it and spent the entire night sewing this GIMP mask together and sewing all the vibrating speakers onto it. And then they attached it all up to an Arduino and a webcam. And so as you navigate the room with this mask on and you creep everyone out, different parts of your face start vibrating. And so different parts of your face start vibrating based on which parts of the room are lighter or darker. And so in this sense, you can begin to sort of feel sight and feel your way around the room through touch, which is pretty cool and pretty creepy. So that's a bunch of really cool invisible stuff, but there is also interesting stuff in the visible realm as well. In fact, for some people, the visible realm is the future. The SETI Institute, which is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, has traditionally looked out for radio waves as a way of detecting extraterrestrial civilizations. The idea being that if you're intelligent enough, maybe you could build a radio transmitter. Although they often have a joke saying, how many of us know how to build radio transmitters? Maybe in this crowd, a number of us, but maybe not everyone out there. But while they've been looking for radio waves, and they'll continue to look for radio waves, they're actually setting their future sights on sight. They're actually starting to look out into the universe for light pulses that could otherwise only be generated by intelligent civilizations. So they're actually switching from invisible to visible to search for the future and search for extraterrestrial civilizations, which is pretty cool. And light makes a lot of sense to search for. This is just a very recent light pollution map of Europe that I pulled. And light not only makes sense to search for extraterrestrial civilizations, but it also makes sense to search for exoplanets. And exoplanets are essentially just extrasolar planets or planets around other stars. And so it's really interesting to me to, if you ever get a chance to look at the Milky Way or look at least the few stars that you can see from London, to think about the planets that might be around them. There's a lot of planets around them. The current estimate is that there's 1.6 planets per star in our galaxy. And so that puts it roughly at 160 billion planets in our galaxy. Quite a lot. And we've been finding a lot, but maybe not too many. We've only found around 800 or so of these exoplanets. So there's a lot left to be discovered. But the way in which we're discovering these exoplanets is interesting. Essentially, through NASA's Kepler telescope, we look at starlight very closely, and we can actually detect if that starlight dips in brightness at all. And so if an Earth-sized planet transits in front of a star, the brightness might actually dip down by only like 1/10,000th, something very small. But we can actually detect that dip in brightness, and we might be actually witnessing an exoplanet going in front of its star, which is pretty cool. And so NASA has a bunch of great algorithms for detecting these dips in brightness and these light curves and detecting if we might be looking at an exoplanet. But there's a project called Planet Hunters that bets that despite NASA having all these great algorithms, humans can probably find some exoplanets that otherwise would be left behind by them. And this is because, essentially, while algorithms and robots are great, humans are still a lot better at pattern detection than they are. And so through Planet Hunters, you can actually look at this light curve data and go on there and actually detect if you see dips in brightness. And if you do, you might be well on your way to discovering an exoplanet. And the great thing is, through Planet Hunters, if you do discover an exoplanet, your name will go on the scientific paper as someone who helped discover it, which is pretty cool. And so people have already detected a number of exoplanets through Planet Hunters, and you can probably detect a lot more. It takes like a couple minutes to sign up. So while searching for life is a very interesting subject and people have dedicated their entire lives to it, searching for life in the universe specifically, people have even created entire mathematical equations for searching for life in the universe. I loved this image because this is the famous Drake equation, which is essentially telling us the probability of finding life in the universe based on a variety of variables. And I just loved it because when he retired, they put his mathematical equation on a cake. I thought it was geeky and funny, but that's just me. So while searching for life in the universe is definitely a very interesting topic, I also often wonder about seeding life in the universe. Instead of discovering life in the universe, what if we actually kind of put it there? What could we do? And so this is something that often gets looked at in the discipline of astrobiology. And astrobiology is essentially just the intersection of space exploration and life or life in the universe. And the sorts of stuff that come out of astrobiology are creepy and weird and awesome, and I just love them. One of my favorite examples is this. How many of you are familiar with what you're looking at? A few of you, okay. I was curious about this audience, how geeky it went. These little guys, this is not actually a fabrication. This is a microorganism. It's less than a millimeter long, and it's called a water bear. And what makes these little water bears creepy is not exactly how they look, but what they can actually do. Essentially, for whatever reason, we've sent these tiny little water bears into the vacuum of space and discovered that they can actually survive for several days without dying, which is terrifying. These are the things that might haunt your dreams, because I could just imagine in the future going out onto a spaceship and then encountering tons of tiny, scary space water bears that look like this. And I don't know. It scares me, at least. But I find it fascinating, this idea of taking life here on Earth and exposing it to space and kind of seeing if it dies or not. I'm probably a bit dark. But yeah, these creepy little space water bears are fascinating in what they are able to do. Another example from astrobiology that I love that's less creepy is this. This is lichen. And lichen's not too exciting. But the cool thing about lichen is that it was one of the first things that helped colonize the Earth over 400 million years ago. And this is because lichen is very good at breaking down bare rock surfaces and really giving a foothold to future life forms. And so, kind of like the space water bear, we've exposed lichen to conditions in space, not the vacuum of space, but we've actually exposed it to the conditions on Mars. This is a chamber that simulates what it's like to be on Mars. And so we've actually found that lichen can survive on Mars. And so, also fascinating to think about how lichen might actually help us colonize Mars the same way it helped us colonize the Earth, as an interesting topic. So astrobiology might seem like something that's completely far removed from what you do day to day, and that might be true. But there are now opportunities for you to get involved in astrobiology that don't necessarily mean you have to go back to school to. You just have to have weird ideas like taking little microorganisms and sending them into space. So there's a great project called Citizens in Space. And what they're doing is they're taking CubeSats, which are these 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter small satellites, and they're sending them up into space, and they want 100 payloads to go into space. But these payload ideas are going to be coming from people all around the world. And so they're selecting 100 ideas to go into space. But they're also specifically looking for astrobiology ideas as well. So through Citizens in Space, you can actually just send them an idea of what you would love to send into space, and they might actually pick it. And you might actually have an experiment in space, whether it's creepy or not, flying within the next couple of years, which is pretty cool. Other parts that I find fascinating is not necessarily taking life here on Earth and sending it into space, but having life here on Earth inspire what we send out into space. This is a tumbleweed, and we're not sending tumbleweeds into space. That would be pretty messy. But we have actually design things, we're actually in the process of designing things inspired by a tumbleweed. The next generation Mars rover, so not Mars Curiosity, which you've no doubt heard about, but the next Mars rover that comes out of NASA, the design of which is actually inspired by a tumbleweed, which I think is really cool. So if you can imagine how a tumbleweed moves across the surface of the Earth, and imagine this robotic tumbleweed moving across the surface of Mars in a similar way, that's what they're actually doing, which is pretty cool. So this is a very early prototype from 2002 of this sort of tumbleweed concept being tested out in Alaska. So NASA has actually been working on this idea for a number of years, and they will continue to work on it for a number of years. And having a robot designed like a tumbleweed makes a lot of sense, because sometimes the alternatives can look like this. It's a very sad robot. So there's a lot of ideas around different types of rover designs. And while this is a very sad robot, the story behind it is kind of cool, because this is a Mars robot that was designed by a bunch of university students through a project called the University Rover Challenge. And what the University Rover Challenge does is every year, university students from around the world actually start building what they would want a Mars rover to be. And so they actually have a competition. Some of them unfortunately fall over like that. But it's actually a chance for people to start building what the next generation Mars rover design could be. And it might actually be incorporated into a space organization's designs for what they actually send out into space. Other interesting things to me are things like this. This is the Telstar 1, which was one of the first telecommunications satellites. And it was incredibly influential. It's where we got the phrase live via satellite from. And so just as much as things here on Earth can inspire things out in space, I also find it interesting how things out in space can inspire things on Earth. The coolest thing that I think that came out of the Telstar 1 is not that it enabled, yes, television pictures to be sent from around the world. Yeah, that's very cool. We can take it for granted now. But the coolest thing I thought was actually that the design of the modern-day football came from the Telstar 1. The Adidas Telstar football design was directly inspired by the satellite. And so I just think it's really cool to think about how a satellite actually inspired how a modern-day design was created here. So just really interesting concept. So I really just love exploring all of these connections between life, the universe, and everything. Sometimes they're weird and undefined and unknown. And sometimes they take many years to happen. But also sometimes they just take a weekend to happen. And I think events like Science Hack Day actually help enable this. Science Hack Day is essentially an event where scientists, designers, developers, and just anyone gets together in the same physical space to see what they can rapidly prototype with science in 24 consecutive hours. The very first Science Hack Day was created in the UK by Jeremy Keith, so you have him to thank for that. And ever since then, they've been happening around the world. And the thing that I love about Science Hack Day is essentially, it's really about exploring all these unknown and undefined concepts. A lot of hackathons nowadays, I think, focus on creating real solutions to real problems, which is good and great. But I really think hacking and hack days is more about just getting excited and making things and not really caring where they're going and not really knowing where they're going. Really just pure excitement. And so some of the weird things that I've seen come out of Science Hack Days that I love are things like this. This is essentially, someone wanted to create a typeface in which each of the letters had equal wind drag. I do not know why. Doesn't matter. So what you're looking at is actually a makeshift wind tunnel, and someone actually recorded the wind drag of each individual letter. And they weighted each individual letter so that all the letters would have the same wind drag. So if you want a typeface in which all the letters have equal wind drag, this is what it looks like. They called it the IsoDrag typeface. I have no idea who this benefits or how it could be used or where it will go. It might just go nowhere, but that doesn't matter. My other favorite example, which is a little bit different story, is a device called the beard detector. Someone wanted to create a device that would essentially tell him when he needed to shave. Many of you may also have this issue, I don't know. So what he did is he actually used a USB microscope, like you can see here. and held it up to his face and got this really gross picture of all the lines on his face. It grosses me out. But so what he did is he used this microscope, held it up to his face. It saw the lines on his face. He wrote some simple code and used an open computer vision library. I'm glad you all appreciate this. This was essentially the same reaction that we got at a Science Hack Day when this was demoed. You could detect if there was a beard or not based on the reading some lines on his face. And so when I first saw this, I thought, that's really amusing, but I have no idea what that has to do with science, but whatever. But sitting in the audience and seeing this was a particle physicist. And the particle physicist saw this and thought, wow, this would actually be a genius way to detect cosmic rays in a cloud chamber. Which sounds ridiculous until you see what cosmic rays in a cloud chamber looks like. It's a bunch of lines. And so actually following Science Hack Day, this particle physicist created a proposal for how to detect cosmic rays in a cloud chamber using the code and open computer vision library that was originally used to see if someone needed to shave or not. And so to me, this is just what I love about hacking and hack days in general. It's really this overbearing joy. It's really about exploring these sparks to future ideas and future collaborations, and about exploring these unknown and undefined things, and not necessarily knowing where they're going, because you might create a beard detector that helps cosmic rays be detected in our world. Who knows? So to me, there's a lot of stuff that's out there to search for, extraterrestrials and exoplanets. But to me, it's actually this search for experimentation that's so incredibly precious. And I think we've found it through hacking and making amazing things. Thank you.